The article's basic perspective is that the world capitalist economics are in deep and long-term crises. The main strength of the Reader is its multifaceted description of the contradictions of the United States economy and the impact of the crisis on workers and communities. The theme of the Reader is that the post-World War II strategy of capital accumulation no longer works. Rampant automation, increasing international competition, and rising debts have undermined the stability of capitalist society, as we see, for instance, with Japan, who keeps its surplus of trade and its protectionist policies, refusing to have fair and equal trade, free trade, between its so-called capitalist ally, USA. Fiscal crises are paralyzing the state's attempts to mediate in the global economic shakeup. Anti-imperialist victories abroad, democratic struggles at home, and labor militancy everywhere have further shaken the capitalist system, particularly so the anti-imperialist victories like Afghanistan this week that thrills all of our hearts that a great nation has gone communist. We are at a crossroads, URPE economists tell us, with capitalists trying to establish a new world order on one hand and with ruling rising class struggle opening up new possibilities for the qualitative transformation of capitalist society on the other. Some of the best articles are those which detail the impact of the recession on productivity and working conditions, effects on women and minority black workers and brown workers, and the movements of jobs towards the Sun Belt and overseas, thus bringing about a dire economic situation in the United States of grave unemployment amongst poor whites and better than half of the blacks and Indians and Chicanos. These articles stand out because of their clear position that these issues are determined by class struggle rather than the inevitable working out of the forces of production, a position which typifies many of the articles. URPE, Social Democratic. Less satisfactory are a number of articles which suggest that because the state can be a site of class struggle, it can also become the main instrument for the revolutionary transformation of society. The flaw in this interpretation is that the state is not neutral, but develops its structures as a part of capitalist society. Now, I'm giving you a total review of a book that is pretty popular these days, U.S. Capitalism in Crisis, and showing the flaw in its main theme. That is that the state is not neutral, but develops its structures as a part of capitalist society. Few of the articles explain the limits and uses of reform strategies. This vaguely social democratic approach to the state is mirrored in the editorial collective section on political strategy at the end of the Reader, elements of which appear in many of the articles as well. It is encouraging that academic Marxists feel the need to publish a book which contains a discussion of political strategy. However, the URPE analysis is seriously marred by a spontaneous and economistic approach. The editors call for the formation of an anti-capitalist movement consisting of an alliance of everyone who feels assaulted by the current economic crisis. The URPE collective suggests that the only demands the anti-capitalist movement can make are those which make sense to most people right now. Thus, they raise demands for full employment, fighting inflation and changing the government's tax policies. But how will those demands move the anti-capitalist? The anti-capitalist movement toward what the editors delicately call the qualitative transformation of the system. It doesn't fit. The collective explicitly states that they don't have the answers, that they will undoubtedly spring from the experiences of the movement as it encounters increasing resistance from capitalists and the conflict heightens. For the immediate future, they stress the sole progress strategy, the sole progressive strategy is to build the broadest based alliance possible, leaving aside such questions as the goals of the movement until the right moment. This strategy is an essentially economistic approach which relies heavily on spontaneity both organizationally and theoretically. URPE implies that the increasing severity of the capitalistic crisis will spontaneously give rise to the theory which will transform the anti-capitalist movement into a revolutionary, but don't call it that, organization. Indeed, because it puts primacy on building the broadest based movement possible and frowns upon squabbling over details like the role of the working class or whether the goal of this movement is socialism, the URPE, again, let us know who that is. That is the Union for Radical Politics, Political Economics. The URPE in this perspective is way off. The URE perspective may actually block the development of the strategic revolutionary theory we need now, not later. You cannot avoid the issue of the working class. You cannot avoid the classless society concept and class structure that we deal with. You must deal with Marxist-Leninist principles to get any kind of broad-based movement. There's no need to talk in such terms. So this book, some 346 pages, I've given you a synopsis. It's a weighty analysis, but a weak strategy. It's a very popular book today, U.S. Capitalism in Crisis. Another book, America by Design, Science, Technology, and the Rise of Corporate Capitalism by David F. Noble, Destroying the Myth of the Managerial Elite will be the topic. David Noble challenges head-on one of the favorite myths about the current state of U.S. monopoly capitalism that is soon to enter the fascistic, cruel, police-repressive stage, that engineers have replaced capitalists in controlling the production process. Rejecting the image of engineers as pure scientists operating in the classless world of facts, Noble demonstrates that professional engineers have consistently worked to maintain capitalist hegemony in production in his book, America by Design. From its earliest days, Noble suggests engineers were concerned with science for the sake of profit. He destroys the ridiculous but familiar image of Thomas Edison as an altruistic genius, a gentle genius of concern with romantic notions to help people. Instead, Edison is shown as one of the early entrepreneurial inventors, one of the true capitalists who ruthlessly considered the profit angle before beginning a new project. The real strength of Noble's book, however, is his descriptions of how engineers wedded science to corporate capitalism, led it down the road to corporate capitalism. He depicts, for instance, Bell Telephone's numerous researchers put to work on wasteful projects inventing patentable gadgets which assured Bell's continued monopoly over the telephone. Noble also provides a detailed examination of the rise of scientific management, the process of harassing technology to the control of workers, or the process of harnessing technology to the control of workers, one might better say. Noble's main intention is not simply to demonstrate that technologies are developed in the interest of the capitalist class. However, he also wants to show the process by which science is harnessed to capitalist production. He attempts to show that in order to maintain control over the production process, capitalists had to create new and powerful managerial positions in firms largely staffed by engineers without soul or principle. The book's flaw. But it is here that the main flaw in the book emerges. As the book progresses, one gets the uncomfortable feeling that Noble has simply left out a step in his book, America by Design, Science, Technology, and the Rise of Corporate Capitalism. He has seemingly forgotten to explain how the capitalists managed to constrain these increasingly powerful managers from acting in their own rather than the capitalist interest. What his account needs and lacks is an explanation of the mechanisms by which capitalists continue to control the range of decisions made by the engineers, even if the experts are relatively autonomous within certain limits. This failure lends a static quality to the work. Noble's image of technology as the tool of capitalist domination ignores the important ways in which these technologies simultaneously, at the same time, undermine capitalist hegemony. In the introduction to his book, Noble quotes Karl Marx's famous insight that the forces and relations of production appear to capital as mere means for it to produce on its limited foundation. In fact, however, they are the material conditions to blow the foundation sky high. Unfortunately, Noble fails to carry this dialectical approach into the book. Nowhere to be found are the contradictions wrought by technological development in capitalist society. Nor does Noble provide an analysis of contradictions within the engineering process or profession. Thus, while the book provides a good insight into capitalism's use of technology in a barbaric way to maintain bourgeoisie, upper middle class, capitalist hegemony, what we need now is an assessment of how this same technological development and the contradictions it engenders or brings about can be turned against the capitalistic system to overthrow it. Stand by. Now, this is an attack on the concepts of nationalization and expropriation that are being recommended by many U.S. communists. Some U.S. communists are falling into the same trick bag as the Euro-communist, though the U.S. Communist Party, CPUSA, still maintains its loyalty, ostensibly, to the Soviet Union. But at the height of the recent coal strike, many of the leaders of the U.S. Communist Party thundered forth its solution to the underlying problem: nationalize the mines. In the midst of the discussion about the energy crisis and an impending oil shortage, the Communist Party leaders were equally stentorian. Nationalize the oil industry was their solution. When plant closings and reduced profit margins revealed the agonies of the U.S. steel monopolies, once again the Communist Party leaders called to nationalize steel. In a speech just a few months ago, Gus Hall, General Secretary of the Communist Party USA, put it all together. The time has come, Hall said, when the United States, in the United States, we are forced to consider the nationalization of a number of industries. We simply are not going to be able to solve the serious problems of energy, steel, coal, housing, mass transit, and the pharmaceutical industry medical supplies without nationalization. Now, all this sounds pretty drastic, just the thing to make it appear that the communists are on the case with fundamental and radical solutions. And many people with only a hazy notion of Marxist-Leninism or socialism will undoubtedly see it that way. Certainly one popular myth about socialism is that, in essence, it is the nationalization of industry. Some who realize that nationalization is not by itself socialism still see it as a progressive measure, a step on the road to socialism. Others see raising the question of nationalization as a means of introducing the question of socialism to the working class and the masses of the people. But the nationalization of industry is no answer for the working class, according to this viewer, Irvin Sibler, an active Marxist-Leninist, but not a member of the Communist Party USA. He says nationalization of industry is no answer for the working class, either in the short run or the long term. In fact, in his opinion, the bourgeoisie itself is at times a foremost advocate of nationalizing one or another sector of industry. This is particularly the case in certain services industries, such as communications and transportation, as we've seen with recent nationalization of certain airlines, where conditions may have developed in such a way that no single group of capitalists can afford to operate in those areas profitably, and yet the capitalist class as a whole needs the functions performed by them. The Postal Service, for example. This was the case with the postal system in virtually all capitalist countries. Historically, the postal services originated as private enterprises. But for a variety of reasons, the bourgeoisie soon realized that it was in the mutual interest of the entire class to have the postal service operated through its common state apparatus. First of all, the postal service was one area where the bourgeoisie ruling class wanted to eliminate competition completely. For here was a vital business, service needed by the entire capitalist class. Secondly, it did not want to create a situation where any one group of capitalists might be able to exercise control over the mail service to the advantage of its particular financial holdings. This included maintaining the sanctity and security of the mails, with the notable exception of political literature and the mail of subversive individuals and organizations. Of course, those things are censored. So, in every capitalist country, the postal service was nationalized. That is, the bourgeoisie state operated it for the mutual benefit of the capitalist class as a whole. But doesn't the post office serve the public? Actually, no, indeed. The bulk of postal services are performed on behalf of business. Business rates are much cheaper than those services which individuals use the most. Bulk rates, second-class rates for periodicals, third-class rates for merchandise, and fourth-class rates. Books and other educational materials are all less costly than the first class rate, which is how the ordinary working class person has to send a letter. Now let us look at transportation. The same is true of transportation. Up until the mid-1930s, the New York City subway system, for instance, was privately owned. Then it was nationalized or municipalized, would probably be the more accurate term. The reason? The 5-cent fare did not provide a high enough return on investment for the subway owners, and raising the fare at that time would probably have been of an incendiary move. It would have inflamed passions too much. So the New York City bought the subways from its owners. Actually, the city did not have the money to pay for them, so it borrowed the money from the over and ever accommodating New York banks. 40 years later, New York continues to pay the banks interest on these loans. In actual dollars, the loans have been repaid several times over, but the original principal indebtedness remains as it was, and the prospects are that it always will. So capitalist interests are gaining money from a continued loan that never will be paid off. Since that time, the subway fares in New York have gone up 10 times. The subways receive some subsidies, underwriting that is, from the state and federal governments, but the principle has been established that the subways have to pay for themselves. That is, the fares have to cover operating costs. This is a neat device for pitting one section of the working class, the subway workers, against the rest of the working class, which rides the subways. Thus, fare raises are always tied to wage increases for the transportation workers. But the huge department stores, industries, and commercial establishments, who would not be able to have the services of a workforce without the subways, literally get a free ride. Nationalization is always recommended for ailing industries. This becomes a device for modernizing plants and developing new, high-priced technology at the workers' expense, since the bulk of taxes comes out of workers' paychecks. In many cases, companies and whole industries are returned to private corporate ownership after the state has fixed them up at its own expense. This was the case with the temporarily nationalized steel plants in Britain and with the USA railroads. It was just an appearance of ownership of the people. It was taken over jointly by the state, which is the instrument of the capitalist class, then got in financial good repair and returned to the private sector of monopoly capitalism. Effects of nationalization. The demand to nationalize industry without the accompanying and inseparable demand of expropriation becomes a charade for indefinitely permitting the former owners and the banks to continue to receive the surplus value produced by the workers. The only solution is for all property, means of production and distribution, to be actually expropriated and turned over to the workers. For this is what the multi-billion dollar payouts invariably mean. That surplus value that should go to the workers go to those that own the loans on these industries that only appear to be nationalized. And if they're nationalized by a state that is capitalist, then some of the communist leaders' position in USA are erroneous, because there can be no interest served by a state that is capitalistically owned. That's why I don't like the references by communist nations to the people as a state. We should call it the people or the government, not the state. The state can be a force of evil, as it has always been in capitalism. Last and far from least, nationalization of any economic sector has always provided the bourgeoisie with the pretext for declaring strikes and many forms of collective action by workers in these enterprises illegal, on the ground that then there are strikes against the government. That certainly has been the truth in the postal services and in certain industries such as the transportation industries, railway, and airlines that have been nationalized by the U.S. capitalist government. The nationalization of industry under the aegis of the capitalist state is thus, in practice, a way to disguise the ultimate receivers of surplus value. What is a surplus value? You should all know that now. That is the difference between what the labor receives and the actual value of his labor. What he produces should all go to the labor. But instead of that being so, only a small value of what he produces goes to the labor, and a profit or surplus value goes to the ruling class, the monopoly elitist, the neo-fascist monopoly capitalists that rule USA and have a stranglehold on 66% of the world's population. These are the former owners who receive the surplus value, who receive their share in the form of the interminable pay out. The banks who get theirs in the form of interest, like the interest that's still being received on the unpaid subway system of New York. Landowners who get theirs in the form of rent. Executives who get their share in the form of huge salaries, bonuses, expense accounts, and the like. The other capitalists able to avail themselves of these services are products of the nationalized enterprise at a reduced rate. The various suppliers of parts and materials, as well as the private distributors, wholesalers, and retailers, all of these still divide up the surplus value produced by the workers in a nationalized enterprise. That's what the opposition PPP, People's Progressive Party, under Dr. Chetty Jagan, and the Working People's Alliance, complained about in Guyana. 85% of the business sector is owned by the state. But they still claim that too much surplus value go into wealth for members of the technologists or the bureaucrats, some bureaucrats in the PNC, who do not live modestly like Dr. Reed, the Deputy Prime Minister and head of the party, or Dr. Mingo, who's been a good friend to us, and our liaison with the People's National Congress, which is the party of Prime Minister Burnham. True, a certain number of jobs may be saved by nationalization, but the actual exploitation of the working class does not diminish one iota, and the whole thing invariably turns out to be a windfall for the capitalists. The CP's nationalization policy. But none of this has discouraged much of the leadership of the Communist Party USA from touting nationalization of industry as the greatest idea since Technicolor. Thus, an April 19th article in the Daily World, the newspaper of the Communist Party USA, is euphoric, that's dreamy-eyed, at the prospect of having the U.S. nationalize the railways once again. Author Tom Foley writes about how wonderful a trip to West Germany recently was because the nationalized railroads performed so efficiently as compared to U.S. railroads. I also remember that under the beginning of fascism, Benito Mussolini, who founded fascism in Italy in 1922, and much of the same climate exists in Italy today, the first thing said all over the world about Benito Mussolini, in my memory, was that the railways run on time. So fascists can make railroads nationalized and run them on time. The U.S. is being denied the excellent means of transportation that nationalized railroads are in most countries, writes this writer Tom Foley of the Communist Party, simply to keep a lot of greedy capitalists making, raking in profits. Foley doesn't even blanch when observing that some capitalists themselves are speaking up in favor of nationalization. Why should he? Revisionism is postulated on the premise that there will be a number of monopoly capitalists who at the right moment are going to be reasonable and intelligent about things and simply turn their property over to the workers as soon as they see the handwriting on the wall. And this is ridiculous and has been denounced by the Soviet Union, that revisionism will no longer work, that gradualism cannot take place, that you cannot bring changes of the means of production, the expropriation, the change of ownership of the means of production and the means of distribution without revolution. Impossible. It will not take place peacefully. Gus Hall at least adds a few qualifying phrases, who is a good man and chairman of the Communist Party USA. He adds a few qualifying phrases to his demands for nationalization. In his mind, nationalization means that these industries would be taken out of the system of corporate profits and would then be democratically operated and controlled as public property. Good idea. By elected representatives of the workers and the public, and run for the benefit of all the people, he says. Such industries would then dispense with the private profits and corporate executive salaries. The takeovers must take place through and by way of the federal government. But after the takeover, the workers and the people's representatives must then be permitted to operate these plans. It's plants. How good that sounds. How simple it is. The workers and the public, whoever they are, would run the nationalized companies. Actually, Hall says, they must be permitted to do so, which raises an increasingly interesting question, namely, who is it that so munificently, who so generously grants this permission, and what gives them the power and authority to do so, and what if they don't decide to do it? And to imagine that this gingerbread version of social practice is passed off as Marxist-Leninism, according to Erwin Silber, is just too much to believe. Gus Hall's scenario more appropriately belongs to a collection of fairy tales, grim ones, like being passed off by the Euro-communists who have become a part of the state apparatus in Italy and are even speaking out against the Red Brigade, that are the only group that have done anything of an activist nature and have succeeded in dividing the ruling class by kidnapping one Aldo Moro prime minister after killing five of his bodyguards, and yet have not done a thing to him. But because other members of the ruling class are getting nervous on the fact that the capitalists are not doing one thing, and the ruling monopoly government is doing not one thing, and all the USA multinationals that backed Aldo Moro and for whom Aldo Moro served well are not doing one thing to free him, other members of the government are becoming very, very nervous, and it may bring about, according to the BBC, the actual disruption, if not the downfall, of the Christian Democratic Capitalist Party of Italy. Hall postulates that a federal government so responsive to the workers will not only nationalize industry and dispense with private profits, it will then turn industry over to the workers to run. Who will induce the federal government of the United States to do all this? And what in the world will the monopoly capitalists be doing during this time, to say nothing of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the police throughout the country that I just brought you news earlier of how much terror they are bringing upon the American public? The U.S. Civil Rights Commission says that there's more police brutality in every city of the nation than has ever been known in the history of USA since it began its barbaric murder of the Indians and stole their land and used the black slaves, killing 3 million, to make their own profit. Presumably, Gus Hall thinks that at some point the workers will be strong enough to make this happen, and he is no doubt conscientious in this, unless, like Foley, he is counting on the reasonableness of monopoly capitalists, which, knowing Gus Hall, the writer thinks, is not likely, for he is sincere. But if the workers are that strong, why shouldn't they then be taking over the government instead? Not in some kind of nationalistic program, nationalizing this and that, but an actual revolutionary overthrow of the government is the only hope that the working class can take control of their destinies. Here is the fundamental problem of revisionist schemes. In China, wherever they are, they want socialism without revolution. They aim to get state power peacefully and democratically, which is just another way of telling the bourgeoisie that they intend to play by capitalism's own rules, as the Euro-communists and the Communist Party of Italy have done, even to such a degree that they are supporting the stands of the capitalist regime of Andreotti and joining in alliance with the AFL-CIO, which is an instrument of bossism rather than trade unionism. And they think the workers can get state power gradually by degrees, the revisionists do, slowly expanding that power to nationalize more enterprises and bring various public sectors under their control until one day quantitative, not qualitative, I can assure you, but quantitative change will pass over into qualitative change and socialism will have arrived. This is dreamy-eyed, revisionistic nonsense. In their more sober moments, most revisionists probably realize these events would never come to pass. They are prepared, therefore, to pin the label of socialism on some form of welfare state capitalism in which, like their counterparts in Western Europe, they will share in the management of the bourgeoisie edifice. This is why the demand for the nationalization of industry, no matter how militant it may sound, is the very essence of reformism, not revolution. It directly implies that capitalism can be made to work with a little help from the friends, its friends in the revisionist communist parties. That's why the Red Brigade and the Red Army have spoken out against all social systems where the institutions talk about gradual change and working for change through the democratic process and peaceful detente and coexistence between capitalist and Marxist-Leninist. That's why they are doing the revolutionary acts of shooting, for instance, the legs of the owner of Fiat and shooting the legs of the deputy prime minister, kidnapping such as Prime Minister Morrow and holding him in ransom for money for further liberation causes and the release of political prisoners, and also to show the disloyalty of capitalists, which already, without one thing being done to Prime Minister Morrow, the Red Brigade is holding, the whole ruling party is about to fall apart. The Red Brigade knows that there are dangers in this, that it may bring about a vicious form of fascism and state dictatorship, but they believe then and only then will the workers awaken to the fact that the state is the enemy. The capitalist state, whether it goes through nationalization policies or whatever maneuvers to look humane, that the state of capitalism is the enemy of the people, and that is the difference between the policies of the Communist Red Brigade and the Red Army as opposed to the social imperialists who believe that change can come peacefully and revisionistically through gradualism and democratic change. This will give you at least food for thought. We want you to always inflame your mind, fan the flames of your thinking and introspection and analysis. Thank you, and I do love you very much.
We found out that the liver was spotted, had leather, had yellow around the liver, and we concluded that it was Newcastle that caused her death. The other layer was, the death was met by accident. She probably ran against the wall or something. We don't know. We found her laying in the morning, stiff. Another is the building that he had for her. Oh, just a minute. I got something else I didn't. And we need the learning crew down with hose to finish the grass around the chicken house. No, they cut it with cutlass, and they didn't cut it very short. So they have to use a hoe to go down deeper to the earth.
Are you still inoculating all of them for Newcastle's disease? That is being done to all of them? Also, I'd like to know, because I didn't get it when I was in Georgetown, I never received an order to purchase more of this medication. If you need it, you better plan out what you're going to need for a year so that it can be purchased right away, because it's getting, our medicines are getting hard to do.
The best I understand is we got some in the freezer.
For a
We only have one.
When I was in Georgetown, you should have gave me that order so I could have picked it up. So you need to get that done right away.
Well, we only ordered for two, so if you want us to order a year's supply, we'll do that.
Medications are getting hard. My point is, you know, get together and discuss it with the committee, but medications are getting increasingly more difficult to get.
You mentioned the learning crew coming down doing the grass cutting. You didn't state how many of the learning crew, because when I was down there, I didn't see that you need the whole entire learning crew to chop that little grass that's there.
Well, hey, brother, the learning crew is going to be down there tomorrow. Anyway. So before this,
I have another request. We want a sleeping pad installed in Building 8 for baby chicks. You know, whoever observed it, we're putting a 24-hour watch on the baby chicks, and we found out we were more successful that way in losses, not having losses. So if we could take some of the old lumber and make a sleeping pad there, we already got the bed. So we just put a bed up there, and so whoever was there all night could at least rest, relax a little bit.
What is the answer on that? Does anybody have an answer about the... What did you want exactly in a way? Was the stall in the building that's already there, or what? No, no, or you want to just set a couple of supports and a couple of boards across to hold the bed up off the ground. Is that all you want? Albert Handy? Yes. Go ahead, Jim.
The Pegri will be glad to donate the chicory a bed.
All right, thank you. That's taken care of. Is that all you have?
All right,
Tish gets that. Now,
I have a question on.
Yeah, I was going to ask for questions now. You have one, Tish. Go ahead.
Yes, both of the items that he mentioned tonight as problems were covered in last week's meeting, and they were supposedly resolved last week. I'm wondering why. Both the hoeing and the, what was the other problem you knew?
Cut less work. You're talking about cutting the grass?
Well, at least the hoeing of the grass was covered in the last two meetings. We've covered this, and both times it was said that the learning crew would get down there. We either need to have better a facility of arranging this or work it out with the coordinator at the end of the meeting, but these things shouldn't carry over from meeting to meeting and be included in every report like this, because that's bad management.
I like to point out, he said that the learning crew came down there and cut the grass, but said they didn't cut it down low enough, and said they needed hoes instead of cutlasses. And from my experience with a cutlass, you can cut it as low as you want with a cutlass.
You can take care of that tomorrow when they get there, right? I mean, there's no problem, right?
Move the agenda.
All right, wait a minute.
He should instruct.
You understand that? Well, you can take care of it tomorrow. All right, so that's settled. All right, fine.
Wait a minute. It isn't going to be settled unless when the learning crew gets down there, you talk to the supervisor and tell him how low you want it.
My dad told him to bring holes, but they couldn't get it low enough with that to bring holes. The dad said that.
Okay, but what I'm saying is instruct the supervisor when he comes there. You coordinate with him and tell him what you want. And then tell him to come and tell you when they're done so you can go and check it so we don't have this on the agenda again.
I'd like to know one thing, Wanda, since you know about the Newcastle disease serum or whatever it is, will it last a year?
When you purchase it, you'll have to check the dates on the bottles, and it goes by the dates, and according to that, coordinate it with what he'll have to do is figure out what his projection of usage will be, and then you'll have to coordinate that with the amount that you purchase and the dates of the bottle.
That's very good, but when the order goes in, this has got to be put down so the one who buys it understands it.
All right, thank you. Now, do we have any more questions about the chickens? All right, let's go on to the next item on the agenda. We'll go to bananas, please.
Okay, the banana report for this last week, we've done a lot of weeding coming up the road, and that was part of our... schedule. We planted 300 banana suckers this last week. We sprayed the back fields and as a regular program. We picked 85 bunches of bananas. There was a little mix-up in the amount after rechecking them. We had 990 pounds, which is one of the greatest that we picked since I've been here. With the alert that we've had this past weekend, we've planted some, with a mixed group and crews, that we planted some 70 citrus trees out in the cottage areas. If you notice, the cottage areas is blossoming right now, and with the new trees going in, and there are a few more to be planted.
Now I'd like to know if there are any questions. Right behind you.
I'm wondering if those new trees have to be watered often, or are they all right the way they are, or what?
What we're going to do is we're going to water them every day for a week. At the end of that time, they should be able to hold by themselves unless we have a very bad dry spell. Now, there are a few of those trees that the... See, we planted them with dirt around the roots, and there are a few that the dirt broke up before we got there. Those are a little bit worse. Some of those are in shock. If you see a few of them that have the leaves drooping, they went into shock. We treated them with vitamin B1, and I don't know how successful that's going to be. However, those will continue to water, and it could be that some of those trees are going to lose their leaves. But don't despair, because even when the citrus trees go into shock and they lose their leaves, very often they'll shoot a new set of leaves. So we really won't know whether we've lost any trees for at least 60 days. And if they lose their trees and they don't their leaves and they don't start shooting for like 60 days, then we may lose a few. But it's normal to lose almost 10% on transplanting. So if we lose a couple of trees, well, we always try not to, but it really isn't the end of the world. We'll just replace them if we do lose a few.
Yes, Becky.
I like to know how much longer will it be before we get some fruit off of them?
Well, I've got my crystal ball right here, you see. Those trees, well, now there's some lime trees there that may bear next year, some of the bigger lime trees, but most of them are about 3 years out. It's hard to say. Some of those little trees have been stunted. Those aren't the best trees. They're the ones we had available after the best were taken out and put on the road. So you'll see all different, as time goes on, you'll see all different things in those trees. You'll see some of them come on very well, some very fast. Some of them probably won't do too well. They're going to take a lot of care and a lot of watching. We planted limes, lemons, grapefruits, tangerines, and oranges, all varieties. Those were all trees that were budded. Jan budded them with her own hands.
Jan, were there any shaddock in that bunch at all? Oh, yes. There's rather an interesting item that we're not familiar with in the States. There's a fruit called a shaddock. It's an extra large type grapefruit, and the meat is pink on the inside and very sweet. When I say large, I mean it's about like this. We first saw some the first October we were here. They had an illustration, an exhibit at Kaituma, and some government people had some from Matthews Ridge, which they grow there, and apparently they think they grow some also around Kaituma now. All right, is any more questions about the banana report?
This is dealing with the citrus. I want to ask you, how long before the breadfruit tree is going to bear?
There will be a nursery report, so if there's any more on citrus, you can ask a little later. Anything else on bananas at this time?
All right, no one on, no more questions. We'll go to the next item. Where do we have a question? All right, Kyle.
I want to know, is any propping being done on the trees? Any propping?
Okay, she asked about propping the trees, and propping the trees is very important. The last week, we have done some propping. We haven't done enough. We have a lot of trees to prop. We've done a lot of cutting today of poles so we can prop our trees. And this program is started. And